Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in French Studies. I'm your host, Roxanne Penchassi. My guest today is Clara Crosten, the author of Credit, Fashion, Sex, Economies of Regard in Old Regime France. And the book was published by Duke University Press in 2013. Hi there, Claire.
Hi, Roxanne. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Thank you for taking the time to speak with me today. I wonder if you could get us started by telling us a little bit about yourself and how you came to work on France.
Okay. So I am originally from Canada, and I grew up in Canada in the, in the 70s and 80s when French was obligatory for all kids in English-speaking Canada. Mm-hmm. I think that might have changed now. And so we took French, and I learned French, and I loved it. And when it turned out that I was not as brilliant as I believed a literary theorist needed to be, because that was my first goal, I decided to do the safe thing and become a historian, and at that point realized that French would really come in handy, and I could do France. I had had great teachers of French history in high school, a great undergrad professor at McGill, John Hellman, and Francophiles in our family. I had actually never been to France, but all things conspired to make me decide to do French history.
And so then you did an undergraduate degree, as you said, at McGill, and then went on to graduate school. Can you tell me a little bit about that experience?
Oh,
your first trips to France?
So the graduate school experience, that is a confession I have to make, although I've actually confessed it elsewhere. So to some people, this may not be such a shocking revelation. Originally, what I did at McGill was 20th century intellectual history, and I also did feminist literature and literary theory. And so I had I was very excited to go off and do a dissertation involving feminism, literature, sex. And then I had a conversation with John Hellman at McGill, who told me that probably it was going to be too competitive for me to get into a modern program because I had had quite a good time in Montreal in my first couple of years, which affected on my grades. And so he said, this will infuriate all the early modernists, just apply to early modern. There's not so much competition. You'll get in, and you can always change your mind once you get there. Well, he didn't reckon with my soon-to-be advisor, Stephen Kaplan at Cornell University, who took me quickly under his wing. There wasn't really much question of the possibility of switching. And in fact, I was so fascinated and delighted by the early modern period from my first semester that I was actually very, very glad. Although I still enjoy the modern period very much, I guess my heart really was won by the old regime and by the 18th century.
Mm-hmm. What about the subject of this book in particular?
Well, so I had the dissertation that I wrote at Cornell University was on seamstresses in the 18th century and the guild that they acquired. And it was sort of exciting. Well, it was for me very exciting research on this very rare all-female guild composed of seamstresses. It was established in 1675. It very quickly became one of the largest guilds in Paris. There was a huge demand among girls and their families for a safe place to place them because this was an all-female trade where the workshops were composed of women, the clients were exclusively women. And I think for many families with a sort of 12 or 13-year-old girl that they were interested in having her acquire a trade, this was a safe and good place to put them. And so I wrote that dissertation. And as I wrote it, I began to think a lot about the daily lives of these women and the kinds of struggles that they faced. And one of the things that became clear, and other historians have written about this, is that debt and credit were extremely important aspects of their life. And so I decided to take up the question of credit in my next book. And but it made more sense to turn to a trade of merchants rather than artisans, because seamstresses actually didn't need as much capital for their businesses as a merchant trade would, because their customers actually bought the very expensive silk cloth and brought it to them, just like today you would bring cloth to your seamstress. And so I focused on fashion merchants instead, who did require a lot of operating credit for their businesses. And so I had sort of conceived a book about economic credit. And I always like to try to combine economic history with the history of society and the history of culture, ideas about gender and representations of it. And so, you know, I was interested in studying also the conception of credit and how that fit in with ideas about fashion and ideas about gender. And that, as I talk about sort of in the introduction and the first chapter of the book, it actually opened up this huge new window that made the book much longer and much more complicated to write than I thought it would be. So my plans actually really changed along the way.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's start with credit, Claire. You know, I think all of us think we might know what that means, but you begin the book with exploring these 17th century definitions of credit, and then move into this discussion of credit in the old regime that you sustain throughout the book in different ways. But what did this word mean? How did it mean differently than what we think it means today? How was it used throughout early modern French society?
And that, actually, that is the question which is really the crux of the whole book. And that answering the question, or discovering that actually was the key question, is what led me in this sort of whole new direction for the book than the one I had anticipated. Because I was thinking of writing a kind of part of the book, at least a chapter or so, doing a kind of intellectual history of the idea of credit. And so now we have, very fortunately, and I'm sure you use this in your own work, and the other authors you've talked to have probably done so as well. We have databases of published sources that are increasingly available from Google Books to more specialized academic ones. So I just very sort of naively put the word credit in there, expecting to get sort of political economy treatises on the circulation of credit and capital in the economy. And I was really surprised when I did that. What came out was rarely actually economic, and it was much more often talking about credit as a form of what you might think of as social or cultural or even political capital. So the influence, if you think of the English use of the word credit, like I give credit to somebody for doing some good deed or something. It's in that sense of the reputation that you have, the positive reputation that you have, and the way that gives you access to influence over other people, to favors from other people, to obtaining different kinds of relationships, goods and services, all different kinds of valuable things, either tangible or intangible, that you might want to acquire.
You say early on that the project began for you as an investigation of, you use the term circulation. And I'm just wondering, in the world of your research and in the world of the book, what are the differences between systems of circulation and systems of credit? Like, how are these terms related, and what do they mean?
Oh, that's a good question. So the, I guess the what I thought that I would find when I entered my term credit in there was that people would be talking about credit as a kind of closed system of circulation in which goods or money were moving around. And so, for example, one of the analogies that was often used in political economy to talk about economic credit was you know, the human body and the circulation of the blood, because that was discovered by Harvey in 1628. The whole circulatory system of the blood in the human body was a discovery of the first decades of the 17th century. And so people adapt that to, well, you see, that's how money and credit circulate within an economy. And it was, and I was thinking, well, you could say fashion also circulates in this kind of in a kind of closed system like that, where, you know, one person sees you wearing that and then they adopt it, and, you know, it goes around like that in a circle. And I think what I would say is the difference, since that's a question that you were asking me, is that in practice, I think people experienced the movement and the exchange of credit and the movement of fashion as much more let's say, ambiguous and much more open-ended and much more complicated than a kind of circular movement of things. So that's the sort of neat, abstract, theoretical system of thinking about how things worked that we can find in some texts. But actually, it's a much more open and messy process. And what fascinated me so much is that there's so much then overlapping. It's not like you have a separate fashion system and a separate credit system or a separate economic system and a separate cultural system. Those things are perceived and experienced by people as completely intersecting and interlocking. And so, you know, you can translate that. And that's why credit is such a fantastic metaphor for the old regime, for their own way of thinking about their world, because you can convert through credit a fashionable hat, an invitation to dinner, a social relationship. All those things actually are a kind, they're currencies that can, that have equivalencies in each other, if you see what I mean. And that's why, so I guess in the end, that's why I think the metaphor of circulation is kind of, is helpful. But if we think of closed systems of circulation, then I think it's misleading. And credit, in the way I've tried to describe it, is actually more helpful.
It's one of the fascinating things about the book, the way that you show that these systems and ways of thinking and experiencing the world overlap through the old regime period. And then, of course, you know, if I keep following the words in the title to begin with, just laying out these terms. So we've talked about credit, we've talked about fashion, and then, you know, you highlight from the introduction on the central role that gender and sexuality play in these things, and how doing a book on credit and the overlaps with fashion that has allowed you to talk about women and gender and sexuality in some really interesting ways. Could you say a few words about that just sort of generally before we get into talking about the different sections of the book?
Sure. Actually, the sex part is the one part where I've had people, you know, the book just came out, so I haven't heard from too many people about it yet, but I have heard a couple of people say, so we get the credit and the fashion. There could be a little more sex. the way that, I mean, Duke did a wonderful job with the cover. If anyone's looking at the cover, the sex, you know, there are fewer words in sex. So the sex part of the title, you know, the cover got really big, which seems...
It's true. I'm looking at it right
it,
now.
It's sex. But there really is a lot of sex in the book. And so the I guess when I put credit and fashion together, it was to underline the ways in which the credibility and the reputation that make credit possible, especially in the old regime, are so much reliant on the embodiment of credibility. You know, performances and appearances of credibility are really important, especially in this period where the media is relatively limited, at least compared to the modern period, where eyewitnessing, you know, seeing people in the streets of Paris is such an important way to transmit information about either your economic credibility or social credibility. And so, and along with the embodiment of appearances comes also the creation of desire and the role of sexual desire as a lever for acquiring credit. And especially because so much of my work focuses on gender, and I was really trying along the way to explain how credit is available to women, and I describe it as a kind of gray market of power. And so because women are excluded from formal authority, this is a very, very important way that they have access to very significant informal power, not all of which, but some of which is leveraged through desire and through sexual relations. And that's kind of, at least when people start to criticize credit in different ways, and I talk about this in the book, one of the ways that they do so is by criticizing the way women use sexual relations and sexual desire to acquire power that they normally shouldn't have.
Claire, you have this kind of wonderful turn of phrase in the title of the book, Economies of Regard. And I was struck by this immediately the first time I heard about the book. And you talk about it a little bit in the introduction. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about the origins of that phrase and of of what it means and how it's working for you throughout.
Sure. So I borrowed this phrase, actually, and I wrote and obtained email permission before I did so from a great economist named Avner Offer, and he coined the term economy of regard, speaking of the contemporary, that is the modern economy, and he, along with I think many other economists, in critiquing the kind of old classical model, neoclassical model of perfect free markets and anonymous free agents interacting in those markets, was emphasizing the ongoing role of things like reputation and people's desire for prestige in their economic interactions. And so that's really important work that, of course, resonates a great deal with the old regime economies that I was writing about. But I tweaked his phrase a little bit by adding economies of regard to underline the way that I was trying to link together different kinds of economies, familial economies, libidinal economies, vestimentary or the economies of fashion. And so that is one little tweak I made. And also anyone who's listening who speaks a little bit of French will probably pick up on the pun implied there, the jeu de mots of economies of regard, because Offner was referring really to reputation and credibility, but I was wanting to highlight there the importance, as I was saying earlier, of the embodied nature of it and the actual, the physical regard, people's appearance and how important that appearance of credibility and the performance of credibility are. And that goes back to everything I was saying earlier about the importance of fashion and the affinities between fashion and credit as two different kinds of systems for circulating information and also for assessing value, different kinds of value.
And it's interesting that, as someone who doesn't work at all on this period, there was a lot of food for thought for me in the book about sort of different theoretical frameworks and ideas and, performance and embodiment. And then also something that you talk about in the introduction, but then I think engage with in different ways throughout the book or prove or underline it in different ways throughout the book is this notion of capital, right? And you discuss this a little bit in the beginning that, of course, as I started to read the book, I was waiting for you to talk about Bourdieu and what you were going to say. And so could you say a little bit about that theoretical framework and how you're interacting with it. I mean, at some point you talk about how you're more interested in practices of credit and economy rather than theories, but you do have some contribution to make in terms of how we think about theoretical frameworks like the idea of cultural capital. Uh-huh. So I was just wondering if you could say a few
words
about that. Sure.
Well, Pierre Bourdieu's different forms of capital, his ideas about the different forms of capital that coexist and that interact with each other is obviously essential for my work. So he wrote at least about social capital and cultural capital and their importance and drew people's attention to the fact that, for example, he has a great book with another sociologist about the role of that in school, the kids that we think are so brilliant, that exceed so naturally, that are just so smart, the role of their cultural capital that they've acquired throughout their lives by having parents who were either educated or affluent enough to take them to museums and to the theater and to talk about books at home, that it disguises itself as innate talent, but in fact, what it is the accruing of this kind of cultural capital, which then enables the kids to acquire social capital and also, of course, further economic capital. And so I think, whenever I'm trying to explain to people what I mean by these different forms of credit and their interaction with each other, of course, the easiest way to explain it is to turn back to Bourdieu. And many people know these ideas either by reading Bourdieu or as they've been popularized by other people. And it makes a lot of sense, and people know they get what I'm talking about. But I did try in the introduction, to acknowledge that debt, but also to somewhat distance myself from Bourdieu. And I think, it's possible that people who are, experts on Bourdieu may I mean, interested to hear how they react to my reading. But what I say in the introduction is that there's a suggestion in much of Bourdieu's writing on different forms of capital that the primordial form of capital is economic capital, and that the social and the cultural are sort of disguised forms of the economic, and what it really comes down to ultimately is the economic capital. And I think, at least for the period that I write about, the 17th and the 18th centuries, and the early 19th century, part of the argument that I'm trying to make here is that I don't think that that's the case. And so given all of the informality of much of the economy, the non-fixed nature of the value of money itself, because the relationship between the livre as a unit of value and the actual coinage can be shifted by royal decree, and the various other elements of the economy that I discuss in the book, it's actually, you know, economic value in and of itself is not all that clear or all that fixed. And on top of it, I think for many people, and this is really what I spend a lot of time discussing in the book, and you may be planning to ask me more questions about it later, but I would just say now that I think that, you know, the issues of social and cultural capital could be equally as important to people, even more important to people than just money or economic capital, for a variety of different reasons. And so I think, at least for the old regime, credit is actually a much more useful category to think about than capital.
Well, it does seem throughout the book, really, that you're showing the way that when we look at credit, it allows us to talk about, you know, not just elites and sort of court and noble society, but a much broader sort of spectrum of social classes and groups, to talk about men and women, to talk about the cultural and social realm as well as the economic realm. So it does seem like a way into this much broader examination of old regime society. At some point, I think in the first chapter, you say, and I'm quoting you somewhere on page 54, I think you say, credit was the informal, often hidden dynamic that explained why things happened the way they did in myriad areas of life. And I'm just wondering, you know, how you move into that in the book, and what role women play in that kind of broader analysis of credit in old regime society.
So when I you know, typed the word credit or crédit into the databases of published sources, there were, you know, enormous numbers of references started coming back at me, and I sort of had to start classifying them to try and analyze them, you know, systematically and figure out what I was really dealing with here. Because in fact, I was quite surprised to realize there was no, or at least there was not much secondary literature on this more immaterial notion of credit as I've been discussing it. So when I got the hits back from the databases, I thought, wow, there's this whole expanded notion of credit that can be political or cultural or social. Let me go find the books written about that. And so I sort of, you know, started looking for bibliography, and I realized, wow, nobody has really written about this. They had written about it in political terms, at least at the French court, which is sort of my starting place, and I discussed this in the book. But the ways in which credit wasn't just about the mutual exchange of influence and favors between courtiers, but, you know, was also related to who you got married to, the power of the Jesuits, the way missionaries worked in different places. Nobody had really taken on that whole nexus of credit. What a great source that I cite in the book described as this, you know, the regime of credit in France. And so that's really just by assessing the sources that were coming back to me and from the databases, opened this world to me and convinced me that even though it wasn't my original plan, I needed to start writing about it. But the obvious place to start is really at the court, because that's where historians had noted it before, and that's where you find quite a few sources. And just to give you a brief example, a lot of people are familiar with the memoirs of the Duc de Saint-Simon, who was at the court of Louis XIV at Versailles, and he was sort of opposed in many ways to things that Louis XIV was doing. And so his memoirs are kind of cynical and sometimes a little bitter. But he uses this idea of the credit of, you know, the king's mistress, Madame de Maintenon, or the credit of different ministers as a way to account for how important decisions get made, who gets different patronage posts, why things happen the way they do in a monarchical system. He explains this as due to the kind of, if you imagine, you know, a stock exchange, he's taking the daily readings of the fluctuations of everybody's credit power. And for him, this explains why things happen the way they do, why important what we would call political decisions get made. And then I started there, and then I expanded out to talk about the various other realms of French life that are affected, I mean, in which similar analyses are being made in contemporary sources.
You begin the book, Clara, with this sort of pretty impressive discussion of the credit as a category of analysis, and then with this discussion of the critiques of credit, you know, this, and that you've just begun to talk about again, from the period of Louis XIV through to Louis XV, so from the late 17th century to the mid 18th century. And I'm just wondering, you know, if you could say what changes in this sweep that you do, this kind of narrative that you trace of perceptions of credit, and especially sort of opponents of credit, and where those voices of opposition are coming from, and what the arguments they're making are. What would you say, in general terms, changes from the late 17th to the mid 18th century in terms of perceptions and understandings?
Well, Roxanne, that's a great question. And it's actually, it's sort of a question at the heart of the book, which plagued me a great deal because, I mean, I really struggled with this question because on the one hand, and maybe this shouldn't be so surprising, I guess, it's sort of a 18th century angst. I mean, an angst of 18th centuryists that you know, why do I start the first chapter where I'm talking about these different ideas about credit? I sort of talk a lot about the last decades of the 17th century, and I kind of leave it there. It's because I got so many hits on my database query that I ran out of time and ability to analyze them. I got to Madame de Sévigné, and I was like, okay, enough. I've talked about so many different things. And it seemed to me as I read through, I mean, I read this stuff from the 18th century, that a lot of it stayed very much the same. And so the same discussion of, you know, the credit of a wife with her husband, the credit of the angels with God in heaven, or the saints, sorry, with God, you know, those kinds, that kind of analysis of credit operating in multiple sectors of life, you could have the same quotations basically running from 1650 at least to the French Revolution. So in some ways, it doesn't change. And one of the things that doesn't change is that women, especially women who are you know, born into noble or wealthy families, women have a great deal of access to credit in all its many guises. And people take that to be completely normal. It's normal to flatter the credit of a princess. It's normal to write to the wife of the president of the parliament to beg for her credit to get your lawsuit, you know, to win your lawsuit. And so in some ways, things don't change. And I wanted to be, I wanted to give space to that narrative in the book as well, because I think the problem of writing 18th century is, of course, we have this revolution looming over us, and we end up often writing the story towards the ending, you know, I mean, in a very teleological way. We can't help but write towards, you know, to explain why this thing happens, whether explicitly or implicitly. And I think in women's history or the history of gender, that has been very strong. And so I was trying to be true to what I saw in the sources, which is in some ways things don't change. There's a longue durée of this way of thinking about credit that is certainly the case. However, and I'm sorry it's taking me a long time to get to the critique part.
No, go ahead.
The critique part is also true as well, which is that because credit is the kind of, as I say, that, you know, the secret knowledge that everybody has about how things really happen, it's not official and it's not authorized, and it doesn't follow always the normal hierarchies of the old regime text, social taxonomy. And also it's not subject to kind of normative official rules in the same way or regulations. And so you have people who feel marginalized and persecuted and oppressed for different reasons who, among their different denunciations of what's happening in France, they denounce credit as this capricious and abusive form of power that people use to crush those underneath them. And so you have people like the Jansenists or the Quietists using the language saying, you know, Jesus had no credit. That was what was so special about him. And we also have credit and we're being crushed. And then you also have moralizers, you know, against La Bruyère and others who critique the court by saying, oh, everything there is credit and self-interest. And but this starts to move in, you know, I guess a politically significant way during the Regency after the death of Louis XIV, when people can be a little more outspoken in criticism and they're thinking through, well, what can we do to make this government less susceptible to a turn towards a kind of despotism? And one thing they say is, different people say, is the credit of women at court is a problem. And so this is identified. It's not totally discredited, and it doesn't become an enormous issue. For many people, it remains, as I've said, totally normal. And yet there's a kind of thread that picks up. And what interested me is that this is well before the now notorious critique of Jean-Jacques Rousseau against public women. You already see in the Restoration a fair amount of criticism directed at the powerful credit of women at court through sex and sexual desire. Develops over time. And so I get eventually in the book to the chapter on Marie Antoinette, where her multiple credit failures become a target. But there is, and this is what I'm talking about in chapter two, there's a long kind of prehistory to that, which starts to ramp up in the time of the regency of after the death of Louis XIV.
Well, in the third and fourth chapters of the book, Clara, is when you really start to move. I mean, you talk about fashion and sex and gender before this, but you really start to move into, you know, these wonderful turns of phrase, the intertwined circuits of credit, fashion, sex, and then talking about fashion merchants. So I wanted to ask you about that sort of section of the book and how you're looking at there's this wonderful quote on page 137 where you say that credit and fashion functioned as information systems based on rapidly evolving and unequally accessible forms of knowledge. So I guess I'm wondering, you know, what does this mean? I think especially from a contemporary reader's perspective, that is both, you know, really provocative because we have our own ways of talking about information systems. But I think it's a really interesting way to go back to the 18th century and to talk about these things. So I wanted to ask you about that. And then, you know, moving into, you talk about this in chapter three and chapter four, and continue to talk about these, the female fashion trade of the 18th century and fashion merchants. So I was wondering if you could talk about these overlaps between credit and fashion, and then, you know, move into the kind of practical experts and actors in the practices of credit and fashion that you start to get into in more detail in the middle of the book.
Okay, so the chapter three moves us to discuss fashion sort of explicitly and to talk about the ways in which to go back to the sort of original plan that I had in the book to think about fashion and credit as forms of circulation, and I wasn't, I guess, at the very beginning, I don't know what book I would have written if I had ended up writing that book, but given the book that I did write, what I was interested in thinking about, were there affinities between the ways that credit functioned and the way that fashion functioned? And I don't know if that seems, you know, from a contemporary person's perspective, really wacky and strange, but when I thought about it, it to me, it seemed to make a lot of sense because in the 18th century, there's no credit bureau or credit. You know, now you want to know your credit score and they give you this precise number, right? There was no such thing in the 18th century. And so because one thing just to say very quickly is that other historians have established this before me, most commercial exchange happens on credit. So there's not that much buying and selling that involves actual physical exchange of money for various reasons, but a lot of it is happening on credit, wholesale and retail. And so a lot of people's attention was given over to assessing the creditworthiness of the people that they were dealing with. Should I sell to them on credit? Or also the attitudes toward credit. Is this person going to ask me for the money now? Are they going to let me have 2 more weeks? Should I buy from this merchant who will be a little bit more patient? Or should I go, you know, what strategy should I use to distribute my credit across different suppliers or et cetera? And so assessing the value of people and of things was really important and took a lot of time. And I think and this information circulates, and it circulated given the limited print media that existed. It circulated through networks that were very much oral and also, as I've said, visual. You know, you have to watch, is the guy looking me straight in the eye? Is he fidgeting? How can I judge him or her? And so therefore, as this sort of economics jargon, these were asymmetric information networks. Some people had more knowledge than others. It was a struggle to gain this knowledge. If you had knowledge, you might not want to share it with other people, et cetera. And so that's credit. And fashion, I would, you know, I came to the conclusion that fashion functioned in quite similar ways, which is who makes something fashionable? Just like, you know, who says what, how much credit you can have. There's no one person. It's an anonymous system, and it's a collective judgment passed. You know, one of the things that the court manuals and other literature of the time make clear is that, you know, you can try and make your own, make a fashion, launch a fashion. If you're successful, wow, you can gain in prestige by doing that. If you fail, though, it's quite risky. And so, anyway, thinking it through, it seemed to me that the way information about fashion circulated and the way judgments were formed and the kind of stakes that were at risk, all that there were multiple affinities between credit and fashion. And then when you start to look more closely at the literature, what's interesting is that, in fact, they often use these words interchangeably, you know, things like vogue and mode and credit. They use them to mean the same thing in many cases. And so they're sort of aware of and playing with those affinities. And I end chapter 3 by talking about I talk about the ways in which just like credit, you know, functions across many spheres, fashion also functioned across many spheres of life. And so we're not just talking about dresses. We're talking about, you know, that there's a satirical and a critical literature about the way that there are fashions of eating and fashions of speaking, fashions of gesture, fashions of whatever you can think of. And in the end, people also become items of fashion. And so there's a wonderful phrase, l'homme à la mode, which becomes quite popular in the 18th century to talk about the man who is himself the object of fashion. And that's sort of, for some people, the ultimate ridiculous thing. But it's a question of, you know, a person himself being elevated in that way. And at least in the 18th century, as I figured out, it's often because of his sexual desirability to women, in fact, that he becomes à la mode. I didn't get to the practicalities there, but that's the sort of conceptual way I think about the information systems of fashion and credit resembling each other.
Well, and I have more questions on that, I don't want to take us down a rabbit hole, but I kept thinking as I was reading the book, and I, even though I am a 20th century historian, I do teach a fourth year seminar on the French Revolution, that, you know, we look at the 18th century before we get into, you know, obviously the revolution itself. And I kept thinking, oh, this parts of this book would be such a great companion piece to our viewing of like films or reading literature like Les Liaisons Dangereuses or Ridicule. I kept thinking about Ridicule and how much of that film this book illuminates and vice versa. Like they're kind of good companions.
Well, what I kept thinking as I was writing the book, which is, I think it had to be said, but at some level, this is what we all, you know, this is what they all already knew about their century. And this is what we already knew intuitively about their century. Everything that we see in a movie like Liaison Dangereuse and the importance of clothing and performing and acting and credibility and reputation and the stakes that people were playing and the interaction of their social position, but also their sex lives, but also money. You know, it really brings everything together, and it illuminates what we already new in many ways.
Well, and it also illuminates, just to move into that issue of the practicalities. I mean, those are the maybe most sensational, most romantic, with a lowercase r, aspects of the old regime and the sort of lead up to the revolution that we all know and that is there in popular culture well beyond, mm-hmm. The walls of universities and scholars and stuff. But you also illuminate in the book this, you connect, I guess, that, set of appearances and performances and the kind of literary imagination that goes along with the old regime to the very real workings of, and maybe this is, your previous book that allows you to do this, to the fashion trade and to fashion merchants. And so I guess, grouping together, because we won't have time to talk about each chapter in detail, but grouping together is sort of some of the things you get in mm-hmm. the center, the middle of the book. What was a fashion merchant? What was this social magic that they performed? What do you have to say about the origins and growth of the trade and relations with clients and some of these kinds of things in relationship to these big ideas, these sort of abstract and overlapping notions of credit and fashion. And then I guess I also want to ask you to tell us a little bit about some of the main characters of the book, especially this Rose Bertin, who I, never heard of myself, but who's this really important figure in the kind of behind the scenes, not so behind the scenes, but in the story that we know of Marie Antoinette and fashion and the revolution and sex and credit and all of these things. But you come at this in this really practical, material way. And I'd just love to hear you say more.
Yeah. When I get to those chapters, which I guess are chapter 4, 5 and 6, that's really drawing on the kind of, my origins as a historian in a way. And so that's where I talk about the economic and the social history of credit. And for me, methodologically, epistemologically even, but also probably ethically, it was really important to have, I mean, that's sort of the core of the book, I guess I would say, which is the first chapters illuminate and draw together under this paradigm of credit, many elements of the old regime that are familiar to many people, but it gives us a new way of understanding how it all fits together. But having done that, what was really important to me was to say, well, okay, how does this intersect with the lives of ordinary people? And does this whole regime of credit that I talk about in the first chapters, does it have anything to do with ordinary people? Or is this all happening in, some salon or boudoir somewhere? And in fact, what I try to show is that it's incredibly intertwined with the lives of ordinary people. It's ordinary people that make it possible. But then again, of course, it shapes tremendously how those ordinary people live their lives. And also the dynamic of the 18th century. And so I focus on fashion merchants. They are not so much is known about them, and I've tried to contribute in this book to increasing our knowledge of them. The seamstresses get their independent guild in 1675, and I think that is a really important moment in the history of the garment trades and in the history of fashion and gender. And its relationship to gender, I guess I should say, in the period. And because they established this very large all-female workforce who were only allowed to make women's clothing. And as I said earlier, many, many thousands of women stream into this trade, and their labor is relatively cheap. And so you have a huge push from the supply side of women skilled artisans there begging to make clothes for other women. And I think the fashion merchants build on this opportunity. The seamstresses sew clothing. The fashion merchants are one step up the economic food chain, which is that they make the decorations for the dress. So if you imagine all those images from Liaison Dangereuse or whatever, the Boucher paintings, all of that very decorative kind of Rococo stuff on the exterior of the dress, the ruffles and the trimmings, that is the domain of the fashion merchant. And that's obviously very expensive, often materials that they're working with. And then you also, they make things for the head and shoulders. So the fabulous hats, the 3 feet tall poufs, as they were called, these big headdresses, the ones with the ship, that's the cover of the book, has this big ship on it. Right. That the fashion merchants make those. And so, and what you see happening is a kind of collaboration in the crafting of the fashionable appearances that allow women of certain social and economic groups to claim the prestige of fashion. That's only made possible through the collaboration of these specialized artisans and merchants, many of them women, who are emerging into the French economy in growing numbers across the 18th century, who work with them, and they gain their own credit within their trade, you know, for what they're doing. But they also make it possible for the, you know, Duchess to make the big splash with her new fashionable headdress. And so there's a kind of interaction between them. And what it means, I argue in the book, is that those dynamics of credit that I try to lay out in the first part of the book are in fact familiar to people of the people. It's not as though, I mean, a lot of people have written as though those kind of questions were really uniquely for the upper echelons of society and didn't touch the people lower down. But I think for the people, at least in the luxury trades, they had to understand those dynamics. Otherwise, there's no way that they could succeed. And on top of it, of course, they're also selling all their goods on credit and they're relying on credit. And because I've tried to argue earlier that the kind of dynamics of reputation, credibility, assessing information and assessing value are similar, whether we're talking about economic or social or political credit. In fact, they're struggling in their own lives with all of the difficulties of juggling multiple credit interactions that anybody else is. So, I mean, the stakes, are quite similar among these different groups of people.
I want to hear you say a little bit more about this Rose Bertin, because she's sort of the superstar of this part of the book in some ways. And you know, you're talking about a whole field of people like her, but she's kind of
she's the star, the
centerpiece. can you tell us a little bit more about her? And I guess, moving forward, that the book does kind of move into that territory of thinking about the causes of the French Revolution and, you know, by talking about Marie Antoinette, who I guess symbolizes this nexus of credit, fashion, sex better than anybody. I wonder what we learn about what do we learn about Marie Antoinette and the origins of the revolution from the book that what do you see as the book's contribution to those debates?
So Rose Bertin, she may be familiar to some listeners. I have a sort of dream of a screenplay one day because that would blow all the Marie Antoinette movies out of the water, because she really is a fascinating character. She's born in Abbeville to a very modest family. There's an autobiography supposedly written by her, which is, of course, I think completely fake, from the first decades of the 19th century that some earlier historians have sort of quoted from as though it actually tells her life story, which I think is sort of ridiculous. But anyway, she comes somehow from Abbeville, probably, as it says in that thing, has worked professionally as a shop girl already in the provinces. But she comes to Paris, eventually opens her own shop, acquires the notice of some prominent court women, and is eventually presented to, I think, now I'm forgetting myself, by the Duchesse de Chartres, one of Marie Antoinette's close friends, introduces her to Marie Antoinette when she's still the Dauphine, that is, married to the heir of the throne. And she establishes a very close relationship with Marie Antoinette, which lasts up until the revolution. She's actually bringing her new dresses in prison to the queen during the revolution. And then she leaves France to kind of save herself shortly before the execution of the queen. But she establishes this relationship, which epitomizes incredibly aptly and brilliantly the kinds of relationships and the kind of mutual dependence and interaction I was talking about a minute ago, because Marie Antoinette has a difficult relationship with her husband. They are unable to consummate their marriage, or at least he is unable to consummate it for the first 8 years. France has been traditionally the enemy of Austria. She's the daughter of the Austrian Empress, and the marriage is the result of the diplomatic revolution, which has created this new, very controversial alliance between France and Austria that many people don't like. She comes to France in the mid-1770s as an adolescent, basically. and she, sorry, she, and so one of, and Carolyn Weber has written a brilliant book about this. One of the things that Marie Antoinette does to try and gain some authority for herself and to gain some space for herself is to use fashion as to attract attention and to show that she's leading fashion and therefore that the court women are following her and that therefore she has some, you know, kind of authority, given that her authority otherwise is so weak, or that her position anyway at court is so weak. And so and Rose Bertin becomes the key collaborator in her attempt to lead fashion. And their relationship becomes so important that Marie Antoinette really violates existing court etiquette to draw Rose Bertin closer to her. She receives her in her in a private cabinet, dismisses all the ladies in waiting, which scandalizes and shocks people. She invites her to court spectacles and makes sure publicly that she gets the best space. She does this wonderful thing of when the royal carriages are going through the city and Rose Bertin comes out on her balcony with her shop girls, the queen actually salutes her in front of everyone, which obliges the entire royal train as well as the royal family to publicly salute this, you know, shop woman, which is shocking again and scandalous. Mm-hmm. And so, but you know, it's a kind of mutual self-fashioning, if I can use that pun, in which the queen has her own interests, and there's a wonderful correspondence among the you know, spy, they're not spies, but the people sent by the Austrian Empress to watch over and supervise and advise her daughter about how to increase her credit. What can we do to make sure her credit is not abused, that other people's credit don't grow instead of hers? I mean, this dialogue about women's credit at court is very much ongoing with regard to Marie Antoinette. So she wants to build her credit. She wants to use fashion as a way to do so. And meanwhile, Rose Bertin is lording it over all the other women in Paris, treating duchesses and marquises kind of very arrogantly. And she seemed to be very haughty based on the queen's patronage. And in the book, I you know, analyze the kind of cascade of credit coming out of that relationship with the queen and all the financial transactions that she does, the cultural credit that she claims. And in the end, when I mean, sort of the contribution to answer your question that I think one of the contributions that I think is important is to show that I learned a lot and I admire very much the historiography on Marie Antoinette and the focus on her sexuality as a big problem and depictions of her as voracious and a lesbian and incestuous. But I try to argue that, in fact, it's not just the sex. If you substitute for the sex credit in all the different ways I've tried to explain it, and you think back to that long history of criticizing women's access to credit at court through sex, it helps you much better understand the criticism of Marie Antoinette and also why her multiple credit failures could stand so well as a symbol for this failing old regime, which is, of course, as we know, bankrupt, and which is led to call the Estates General, et cetera, as a result of the credit crisis that the government is facing. And so I think what I am trying to do is show, not go back to the old financial, you know, to a simplistic financial crisis explanation of the revolution, but to show the ways in which this multiple faceted regime of credit, as one of her advisors, it's his phrase, that really helps us understand what the criticism of the problem of the old regime.
Well, and it seems to me, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong about this, Claire, but it seems to me that those chapters that really focus on that very elite, like the pocket, the very elite, most elite pocket of the elite world, is kind of then echoed in the last chapter of the book where you're challenging maybe some of our, and again, maybe this is just my 20th century historian's ignorance, but some of those notions about a kind of rigid male household authority in the old regime by looking at the ways that, you know, in day-to-day life and, you know, less spectacular consumers, female consumers, in old regime society also used credit, used their husband's credit, and that this kind of gets at maybe some of our more traditional understandings of male authority in the 18th century. I just wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, so I wanted to end by kind of switching the perspective away from, as you said, the court and the queen, but also away from, you know, the previous chapters discussed the producers of goods on credit. And I wanted to talk a little bit more about consumption. And what I found was that the idea that women are financially, married women especially, are very financially restricted, that they're completely under the authority of their husbands, that only works as long as you don't acknowledge the vital importance of credit in economic exchange. And once you realize that most people are buying and selling on credit, and then you also realize that the legal authorities in their treatises on 18th century law write that women have the implicit capacity to buy and sell on their husband's credit without, you know, any kind of formal approval, you realize actually that women do have much more, married women do have a lot more financial flexibility than you realize. And it may have been the case, you know, centuries earlier when that loophole was conceived, that it wasn't such a big deal. But when you have what historians have called the consumer revolution taking off in the middle of the 18th century, the people's, there's a lot more stuff to buy, a lot more shops to tempt you into buying. And I think it starts to play quite an important economic role. And I also wanted to, I thought it was sort of an interesting way to, a new way to think about the marriage relationship and to think of the husband's credit, of his bestowing of his credit on the wife as a crucial part of the marriage relationship. And that, how do you know when the marriage is broken? It's when he says, you know, you can't buy on my credit anymore, go live in the provinces. That trust is gone. And I don't think people have really talked very much about that trust, economic trust, the husband places in his wife as being part of the marriage bond.
Well, Claire, I've taken up a lot of your time, and I want to keep talking to you about the book, but I also want to find out a little bit about what you're working on now. And I kind of want you to say that one of the projects is a screenplay on Lose about that, but you're probably working on some other things. So where is your work taking you these days?
Well, I'm actually in Paris as we speak, and I am writing. I have a wonderful grant from the ACLS, the American Council of Learned Societies, to do a long postponed project that I'm working on with my former dissertation advisor, Steve Kaplan, and a wonderful French historian named Claire Lemercier, who's a 19th century historian primarily. And we're writing a book about apprenticeship. Mm-hmm. And what is particularly exciting is that we're conceiving it as a book that will start somewhere in the 1670s, but go up until probably the 1880s, and treat the revolution, but not be fixated on the revolution, and really try and understand what happens to this institution of apprenticeship with all of its economic importance, but its also role in social formation and social reproduction from the 1670s up to the end of the 19th century.
Well, it sounds like a fascinating study, and I hope I'll get a chance to talk to, well, all three of you. That would be an interesting interview setup. We'll try to figure out the technology for that. Well, Claire, I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me and for writing this really, really interesting and rich book.
Well, thank you, Roxanne. It's been great to talk to you, and I'm really grateful. I know it's a long book, so thank you for making your way through it. And also, it was really a great pleasure to talk to you about it. Thank you.
You've been listening to New Books in French Studies. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I hope you'll join us again next time.